You are listening to Frost Call. This episode was recorded January 22nd, 2011. Listening to Frost Call. I'm Tom Howard, and joining me today is my lovely wife, Wendy.
Hello.
Before we get started today, I just want to remind everybody to check out the website, frostcall.com. On the right-hand side, there's a link to our Facebook page where you can friend us. Be sure to send us any comments, questions, or anything else you have. You can email me at tom@frostcall.com, and you can email Wendy at wendy@frostcall.com. On today's show, we're interviewing Cecil Bothwell. He is an atheist city council member in Asheville, North Carolina, and we're going to go ahead and hop right into that interview. Joining us now is Cecil Bothwell.
Hi, Wendy. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Cecil. So thanks for joining us. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
I'm pleased to be here.
So you are currently a city council member for Asheville, North Carolina.
That's right. I was elected in November 2009, and so I've served about 13 months now.
From some of my research here, I found that you are also a former editor for the Asheville City Paper, a managing editor for the Asheville Mountain Express, former managing editor. You were one of the founding editors of the Warren Wilson College Environmental Journal, Hearthstone. That's a mouthful.
Yep.
You served on a national editorial board for the Association of Alternative News Weeklies. You were a board member for two educational nonprofit organizations working in Latin America.
That's right.
And you also have a weekly print and radio journal, Duck Soup.
Yeah, I did that starting in about 1992. I was doing a weekly syndicated column called Duck Soup, which was also a radio commentary on a public radio station, a weekly commentary. And it was syndicated through Alternet nationally for about 10 years. It's not ongoing now.
Looking at some of your books, I've found several. You have a couple more recent ones. You have Whale Falls, An Exploration of Belief and Its Consequences, The Prince of War, Billy Graham's Crusade for Holy Christian Empire. That's a little pun there.
Yep.
Can We Have an Archaic and Idiot, a collection of fictitious tropes, Gorillas in the Myth, a Duck Soup Reader, Garden My Heart, Organic Strategies for Backyard Sustainability, Pure Bunkum, and that's another long title. I notice you are very descriptive in your titles.
I find that most of my book sales are online, and if anyone sees is the title, I was hoping that it would tell them as much as possible about what was in the book. Because often when you do a Google search, for instance, you just get that title. And it's working pretty well. But or maybe I'm just too loquacious when it comes to titling books.
Well, I think that's actually a good strategy, especially if most of your titles are sold online. I notice you also, all of these books are available through Amazon Kindle Store as well, which is really beneficial if someone's wanting to buy something online.
Right.
From what I understand, you were raised a Presbyterian, is that correct?
Right. My grade school years, I was taken to Sunday school, not strictly, but fairly often. I think my parents thought it was a pretty good influence. Mom had been raised a Presbyterian, and so that was kind of a carryover. My dad was supposedly Methodist because of his parentage, but he was really an agnostic. He was the one who first explained to me. When I heard him saying different words to the Lord's Prayer in church, I asked him what was up.
It's not very hard to get down.
And he said, well, it was pretty meaningless anyway, and he explained agnosticism to me.
Wow.
And by the time I was in, I think when I was 15 is when it really sunk in that I didn't believe all that stuff.
It was in your teenage years when you first started to doubt the religion you were raised with?
Right.
Did you never really have a solid, Do you feel like you ever really firmly believed?
Really not. I mean, I was just, it's what, 13 to 15 is when we, I guess, our age of reason, or, you know, when we really began to get outside ourselves with our understanding. And by the time I got there, the myths didn't really make sense. But the thing is, I hadn't really been pressed about it. No one questioned me about it particularly until I got to the Eagle Scout Board of Review in Boy Scouts. And abruptly, in the middle of that, in those days, and I don't really know how it works now, but after you completed your requirements for the Eagle Scout badge, you had to go before three adults who cross-examined you to establish that you were a good Boy Scout. And one of the three men on that board said to me, "Do you have your God and Country Award?" Now, that's an award that scouts can earn in each of their religions. There's a bunch of different ones. But anyway, you know, you fill requirements serving in your church, learning things about your religion. And I said, "No, sir, I haven't." And he said, "Well, I like to see a boy get that before he gets his Eagle Award." And I'm sitting there thinking, this is not a requirement. You know, it's not one of the things I was supposed to fill. And now you're about to block me? Is that what you're saying to me? I'm thinking, here's this adult with power to block me from something that I thought was a worthwhile goal. And he's suddenly pulling this out of his hat. And I said, "Well, I understand that, but no, I haven't." He said, "Well, if we approve you, I'd like you to assure me that you're going to work on this God and Country Award." And I thought to myself, what am I going to say? Am I going to tell him, "No, I won't"? I mean, this is an adult, you know, who has power over me. And I said, "Oh, I'll work on it, sir." And I felt terrible because I knew when I said it, I wouldn't work on it. So later, I got my Eagle Award, and I carried this around thinking, this is this award that's supposed to prove that you're honest, trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient. And I lied to get it. And that really made me think hard about what I really believed. And so that's when it confirmed me that, no, I don't believe in God, and I'm not going to let anybody else torque me into saying that again.
During your campaign for the city council, at what point did your religious faith, or lack thereof, come to the spotlight?
Well, there were two points, slightly different, different in source and different in tone. When I ran, we have an open primary in this city, so anybody who wants to run for city council can toss their hat in the ring. And that's eliminated down to six candidates at the end of the primary, because there each time there are three seats open. We alternate. We have four-year terms, and every 2 years, three people are up for election. So we were going for six seats, and there were 10 candidates. And I came in first in the primary. Well, I think that some of the more conservative elements in town didn't think before that I was likely to win. And so they decided they had to do something quick. In the acknowledgments at the end of my critical biography of Billy Graham, I had mentioned that I didn't believe in supernatural beings of any stripe, because I knew it might come up since I'd written a critical book about Billy Graham. Well, they took that and wrote a smear letter warning the people of the city that they were about to elect this godless heathen who was going to take the whole city to the devil. Because I didn't believe in supernatural beings. And they nailed it to thousands of people. We think mostly people 50 and older, as far as we could figure. But thousands and thousands of people received this direct mail. And then a week later, a second direct mail went out in which they told the people of the city that I had said that Billy Graham was influenced by Adolf Hitler. And on election day, in fact, one of my campaign workers was working a poll, and a man came up to her and he said, "I'm not voting for that Bothwell. He said Billy was influenced by Adolf Hitler." And she said, "Well, yes, I've read the book. Cecil did write that. And his source was Billy Graham's autobiography." And the guy goes, "Yeah, who wrote that?" Graham talked in his autobiography about listening to Hitler tapes even though he didn't understand German, he felt like he learned about a lot about how you influenced crowds. And he listened to them rapidly as a teenager. Anyway, so that was the smear campaign. And in fact, in the final, in the general election, I came in third. And I don't doubt that those smear letters had some influence on the voters here. I mean, the fact that I fell from first to third, you know, was some indication. Okay, so I won one of the three seats. And then in early December last year, when I was about to be sworn in, two more people stepped forward and tried to block me from being sworn in because the North Carolina Constitution still says you cannot hold office in the state if you shall deny the being of Almighty God.
Wow.
And so does the Texas Constitution, for that matter.
Right. And it's unenforceable but under the U.S. Constitution, which has a separation clause and so forth. But still, they made a lot of news. It was a slow news week, I guess, early December last year. I mean, pre-Christmas, the only news on the news seems to be about shopping. And Rachel Maddow picked up the story. And as a result of that, Bill Press interviewed me on his nationwide show, and the Freedom from Religion Foundation interviewed me, and a couple of other radio people. And then the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times picked up the story. And at one point in December last year, if you Googled my name plus the word atheist, there were over 550,000 hits on Google in at least eight languages. This, I mean, a really non-story, because I didn't stop anything. I was sworn into office. I affirmed that I would uphold the Constitution. I didn't swear on a Bible. But it generated an amazing amount of news for a couple of weeks.
I've been reading your blog a little bit, and I noticed that you had some issues deciding between two beliefs you really firmly held and having to vote. Mm-hmm. For example, some of your things here you ran on were conservation, government reform, transparency. Can you tell us a little bit about the major issue you had in the past year?
Yeah, that was one of the tougher calls I had to make. As you pointed out, I'm an environmentalist, and I'm very concerned to use city policy to reduce our need for foreign oil to help reduce the future need for gasoline, because I think gas prices are headed up. And so I'm interested in making sure that we're at least ready with transit to pick up the slack, because like a couple years ago when the prices spiked, gas prices spiked shortly before what we call the Great Recession, we saw transit ridership go way up here. And I think that as prices climb again, we're going to see that happen and so forth. Well, so I really believe that we need to fashion policies that help make that work. One of those is if we can use our zoning laws to increase density along our transit routes, when there's more people living along transit routes and more people using the transit, you can afford to run buses more often. And buses are much better than cars in terms of commuting, in terms of, you know, energy use. But a lot of people don't like, our buses mostly run on 1 hour schedules. So if you miss a bus, you've missed it by an hour, and that doesn't work for a lot of people. So I'd really like to see the transit frequency go up. Well, we need more density. Okay. On the other side of things, I really believe in transparency. I think that the more we can let people participate in local government, I mean any government, but I'm talking local here, the better government is, and the people deserve to have a say. Now, we obviously elect representatives because it would be unwieldy for everyone to vote on everything. But still, I like to get people involved. Well, we had a proposal that we voted on that would allow builders to increase the density. Say if you're in an area where you could usually build only a quadruplex, mm-hmm. you could build an eightplex. If you met certain energy efficiency guidelines, and certain affordability guidelines. So we're building affordable green housing, and if you do that, you can automatically get this bump up in density. Well, normally an increase in density requires public hearings and letting, you know, the neighborhood testify as part of that whole process. The problem with that is, if you're promising the developer that if they come forward with a green, affordable plan that you will give them the density, you've got to promise them that. You can't say maybe if the neighbors agree. Why? I mean, then you're not really making any, you're not offering any deal. Because right now, any builder can say, can I get greater density? You see what I mean?
Yes, and the neighbor can vote on
it. It wouldn't have been an incentive. We were trying to come up with an incentive. And in the end, I voted for the incentive, which limited citizen input and transparency. And I was called out for it by a lot of my supporters who weighed in more on the transparency side. And I was patted on the back by supporters who said, yeah, you did the green thing. But it's tough. I mean, if governing was easy, we would need less government probably. And certainly there wouldn't, I don't know. I'm not meaning to make it out real hard, but some of it is hard.
Well, it is, because you have, especially when you believe in certain things and you've told your voters you're going to do certain things, once you get into that position where you see the bureaucracy around things and how things actually run, it's not as easy as some people like to think that it is.
Right, right. One of the things I look into in my latest book, that Whale Falls, looking at the way beliefs affect our behavior, the consequences of belief, is in public policy. And I think much of our public policy is emanates from religious or faith-based orientation. One big one, I think, in this country is drug policy. I think we've allowed the notion that it's ethically bad to use substances to make yourself feel good. We got as a kind of a general onus about that to allow us to create laws that have, I think, done way more harm than good. We're imprisoning so many people. And I mean, the truth of the matter is people vote with their feet and people do use substances. So we've allowed alcohol as a legal one. And people don't kill each other over alcohol these days. We haven't had gangs around alcohol since Prohibition days. But a lot of people use other substances, and we're seeing this terrible increase in gang activity, the war, the drug war in Mexico, and all. But I think we need to really debate how we're going about all that. It's not that I'm extolling drugs, but I think we've allowed the moralistic argument to overpower a practical question of what's really the best way to make people's lives better, which is what the government should be doing.
Well, I think when the vast majority of people that are for the drug war are legislating morality in that sense, when the majority of those people are voters, or should I say the majority of voters believe in continuing that war, that's what the politicians are going to push.
Exactly. And I mean, I think obviously officers have to enforce whatever laws we create. I mean, and that's what democracy is about and how the police force should work. But I think we need that bigger argument or bigger discussion. Another area that I look into is diet. Although most of us like to think that who are thinking people like to think that we base our dietary choices on health considerations. Ultimately, they mostly come down to ethical considerations. We have a lot of vegetarians in America and vegans and macrobiotic people, and around the world, people's dietary choices run from no pork for the Muslims and Jews to no lettuce for some Kurds. The Chinese eat cats. Some Southeast Asians eat rats. We don't. We don't consider dogs food, but the Chinese do, because we think of dogs as kind of a higher consciousness than cows, for instance. I mean, cows and chickens are typically eaten here. And all those things involve kind of ethical choices more than necessarily health choices.
Have you listened to any Peter Singer, read any Peter Singer's works?
Yeah, I have. I was quite a fan of his. I was a vegan and in the animal rights movement in the 80s, mostly concerned about factory farming and also about the environmental impact of heavy meat use. And so I read Singer's views on a number of things, and he's really been a controversial philosopher in many ways.
Wendy and I saw him speak at the Global Atheist Convention in Australia in 2010, so last year. I guess his ethical considerations were the strongest argument I've ever heard. I still eat meat, but I get it. I understand the ethical considerations for not eating meat. I'm just not past that in my head. It doesn't. I don't go for animal cruelty. I want to see animals that are in pain and suffering put out of their misery, and I also think that should be applied to humans as well. If someone wants to die, they should have the right to die. I mean, I'm a big advocate for that. I'm just not past eating a chicken or a cow yet. So,
well, I saw the environmental impact of eating a vegan diet, so much of which came from California. So we're trucking it a long way. I'm eating, and what I came down to, now I'm more of a locavore. I try to depend on local farms and local food sources from around our region here, so that whatever I'm eating isn't shipped as far, and it's from small farms where, in my experience, there's a lot more humane treatment of the animals than the battery cages and the hog pens that hold 1,000 hogs and that sort of thing. I'm very clear that I'm making certain ethical choices, and some of them involve the fact that I think I feel better when I eat meat. I like an omnivore's diet. I lost a lot of hair when I was vegan. I really had severe hair loss during the time I was a vegan, even though I took extra vitamins and stuff.
With the global population increasing like it is, many issues arise from what we call organic farming and how it might be using too much land to feed the global population. The current issue of National Geographic has an interesting article on the world's population, and they mention that perhaps the single biggest factor to lowering overpopulation in the future is educating women.
Right. Yeah, I definitely agree with what I've read about that, and it seems like the logical thing to do, and that's one of the reasons I participate in the two educational foundations that work in Latin America. We, in Guatemala and Bolivia, a big focus is getting more and more girls into school. And another piece of what you just mentioned, the fertility issue around farming. One of the big problems that has happened in modern civilization is that we take all of the waste products of the humans who eat the food and we dump them. We used to just dump them, straight pipe them into rivers. But even now, when it goes through a sewage treatment plant, it ends up being mixed with industrial waste and all kinds of stuff. And it's mostly a waste product. In a natural system, animal waste is returned to the soil and is part of the nutrition cycle.
My stepbrother actually uses a composting toilet where he lives because he doesn't have very good soil, and it really helps out.
Yeah. I did that for about 22 years, so I have a lot of experience with composting toilets.
They worked okay. When we had a family Thanksgiving together, and I think once...
It didn't work well with like 12 people,
over
though.
A week period, yeah. So
right.
It wasn't designed for that many people, though, but it held up decently.
Yeah, sizing the system, right?
Considering everything else. In Austin, we actually have what we call Dillo dirt, which is essentially composted human waste, and it's relatively cheap. You can use it and put it on your lawn or put it wherever you like. It's been composted.
And it works wonderfully.
It smells a little bit at first, but it works wonders.
Mm-hmm. Right. If it's composted hot enough, it kills all pathogens. And that's one of the problems with home systems. They often don't heat up enough. So I know on my system, I used it for ornamental, for shrubs and fruit trees and ornamentals, but not for lettuce and vegetables that would be in contact with the soil.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those things where you really have to look at the entire system as a cycle and making sure
Absolutely.
You're putting things back into the soil, especially with our growing population. You got to do something. I mean, water is going to be the next big hot topic. It already is in some areas.
Sure. And another piece of it, like the big hog lagoons, we have more hogs than people in North Carolina, even though we're the number 9 population state. And the waste lagoons from the big hog facilities are not being redirected back as fertilizer to the places that where the feed is grown. And so that's really wasting the waste. You know, again, the natural cycle would be for the waste byproducts to go back into the dirt. That's how the whole natural cycle of plant nutrition works.
Well, one thing, just talking about all of this, it kind of makes me think about our culture here in Austin. We're pretty liberal, I mean, socially liberal, and we have this whole mantra of keep Austin weird. So, you know, everyone does their own thing, and we've really gotten into the culture of doing organic food and, you know, living green and doing these things. And I'm wondering, though, you know, we mentioned Peter Singer, who I think has moral and ethical reasons for being a vegetarian and for living the way that he does. And I wonder if a lot of the people, though, that we see here, at least in Austin, are doing it because it's cool. And it just makes me wonder, is that doing it for the right reasons? And is that going to be sustainable in itself?
I think you've got a real good point there, that sometimes things are faddish and mm-hmm. and maybe don't. Like we used to, when I was first a vegetarian, I kind of bounced in and out of it. When I was first a vegetarian back in my early 20s, we referred to it as being California vegetarians because we ate a lot of avocados and peanut butter and soy. And I don't know, it wasn't necessarily a balanced diet. It was kind of it seemed fashionable at the time. We would have denied it. But once in a while, when we got introspective enough, we recognized that we weren't being the health food people. We weren't being the animal product. You know, I don't. And then later, as I began to understand animal agriculture better, I got it that, for instance, people use milk products, and they think that that's somehow better than eating meat. But they don't. Having raised goats myself, I know that what you need to do is breed the animal every year, or they stop giving milk. And then what do you do with the spare baby that comes along? Well, we call it veal.
Yeah, you eat it.
And we eat it. And, you know, all the chickens that lay eggs, it's fine to be an ovo-lacto vegetarian, but the chickens that lay eggs eventually end up in Campbell's soup. It isn't like the chicken lives a natural life. And it, as soon as it's productive, its high productivity of eggs goes away. It's a food product.
There's so many issues around these different topics that people don't really necessarily understand them all. I don't even understand them all. I just know that there's certain things out there that we don't normally think about.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think that it's important to open up inquiry about any subject, try to keep from going into channelized thinking, whether it's religious thought or broader spiritual or human consciousness thought, or whether it's government policy about whether it's farming or the drug enforcement or campaign finance. We need to really try to discuss broadly what the best solutions for us are, and I think be as little influenced as possible by big players who have a monetary stake.
I agree.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to the religious topic here, you've been an atheist, I guess, for a little over 40 years. Is that correct?
A little over 45 years.
I'm not trying to call out your age.
I'm 60.
I hope I make it to that one day. So.
Yeah, I turned 60 this fall, and it was about 15 when I really got fairly solid in my feelings. Okay. Although I had one aberration during the summer after my senior high school year. I fell in with a bad crowd from Campus Crusade, with a very charismatic young leader, and for a couple of months I was getting swayed, you know, toward the whole young Christian Campus Crusade for Christ thing. And then the fall, I went to college, and it all washed away pretty quickly again. I thought, well, that was weird.
Well, Wendy and I, of course, were raised Pentecostal, so we were out there trying to do the same thing.
Right.
So, yes, you were asking. Yes, it's been a while now that I've been but I've only been a public atheist for a year now. I mean, I didn't really think it was anybody's business, really. I mean, it didn't seem a big deal. And following that, I was tapped by the American Atheist as the most courageous elected official of 2010 in Newark last year. And I've started speaking around the country. I was in Minneapolis for the Minnesota Atheist Convention. I was in Denver speaking to the Denver Atheists recently. I'm going to be in Cambridge, Mass. In April for the American Humanist Association. And I've been working with the Secular Coalition for America. Had Sean Faircloth down here to Asheville. We had an event here. It's becoming more and more clear to me that we do need to speak out. We do need to make clear the separation of church and state. Too often we're allowing religious beliefs to dictate public policy, whether it's on family planning or corporal punishment in schools, foreign aid programs, like the HIV programs and so forth in Africa. Every time we let faith dictate policy, we aren't being true to the best for the people, toward finding the best solutions.
Yeah, I think as someone electing a politician, I would be more concerned on, are they going to look at all the issues? Are they actually going to look at the different sides? I mean, look at our just conversation on food, for example. If the politician already has a predetermined position and they're not open to looking at the different sides of things, regardless of the reason why, whether it be religion, affiliation with some college or whatever, then I wouldn't want to vote for them. I'd want to vote for someone who's open. And to me, it seems that I would want to vote for someone who is an atheist or who has less affiliations with anything, a third party, someone who's a neutral third party who's interested in seeing all sides of the argument.
Yeah. It was the Baptists I'm pretty sure of this historically, at the time of the Constitution, who pressed for the separation clause in the Constitution because they were afraid the Episcopals were going to run the joint. and so freedom of religion is good for religions too.
Mm-hmm. But Tom, it's funny how, I mean, you mentioned, you want somebody who's going to be, nonpartisan on issues and who's going to think freely and that kind of thing. But, I mean, think back to when you were a Christian. Would you have voted for somebody who was an atheist?
No.
Exactly. So.
Right.
Yes.
I mean, it's interesting, Cecil, you mentioned that you, you weren't a public atheist, and then you decided to, really come out and speak against these issues that you saw that are harming our country. And I think more of us have to reconcile that fact and say, it's easier to sit back because you're demonized in a lot of ways. And people look at you in a whole different light. But in order for us to be effective as a group, you have to come out and tell people, okay, this is what I believe. And this is why I believe it. And I'm still a good person. And I still want these good things for my country and my family and my government and all of that.
You're exactly right, Wendy. That's exactly the case. And I think the more of us that are open and able to talk with people about it, and as people see that we're not bad people, it encourages other people to realize that they can be honest about how they feel. Because the truth is, there's millions of people in this country and actually a higher percentage around the world who are basically at least agnostic.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been cowed into thinking that they shouldn't be real open about that sort of thing.
Have you seen a change since you've been an atheist the past 45 years on how the general public sees or portrays atheists?
Well, again, I didn't think much of it. I mean, until this last year, I wasn't really paying attention. I mean, I'd heard about things like Madeline Murray O'Hare and the fuss that she kicked up and the people who were upset about her. And occasionally you'd see something, but I thought, you know, no big deal. I've certainly seen a change, for instance, here in Asheville, a very specific change. In that election campaign, I was elected, and a Jewish woman was elected, and the other person on council is who was elected last year hasn't made any public statements about his position, but about religion in any regard. And the way our council works, a lot of southern city councils have a prayer at the beginning of each meeting, some kind of an invocation. And because of warnings about possible conflicts of church and state, before I was elected, the council had gone to a thing where each council member in turn, instead of having a minister come in, each council member in turn, one week after another, does an invocation at the beginning. And since I've been on there, the tone of the invocations has changed quite a bit. Instead of, it was like just automatic, the other people would go, now will you, bow your head? Now they say, if you'd like to join me, and, then some of them say a prayer, but then some of the Christians, now you quote Jewish rabbis and stuff in their invocations. The Jewish woman has done totally secular, non-religious invocations. Like one, she asked everybody, she said, normally people bow their heads, but I want you to sit up and look around you, because I'm going to talk about the people in this room who are around you, are the people who care enough to be working on city government here. And when I do mine, I quote scientists or whatever I've happened to found inspirational lately. And the tone of the invocations has shifted palpably from where it was before.
Well, that's good. I always enjoy whenever I go to some public event like that where they hold these, which in Texas they do that all the time. I like to keep my head up and look around and spot all the other atheists in the room.
Yeah. The other people with their heads up, too.
Yeah. Just kind of gave a little nod.
And another piece, we say the Pledge of Allegiance at the beginning of each meeting. That's just a standard practice in so many public meetings. I say, one nation under law, indivisible.
Well, the under and God wasn't even added until the 50s.
Right. And I tried for a while just saying one nation indivisible, but when you're saying it in a crowd, you lose rhythm. It's very hard to just stop and not say anything. So I came up with one nation under law, which I believe is true, and it works beautifully.
That's interesting. I'll have to try that.
That's actually good, because we were talking about the other day, like, what are we going to teach our kids to say? So that's great. Actually really good.
And, you know, everybody else was saying it, so nobody, you aren't even really exposing yourself to much criticism, because nobody really else notices what you're saying.
Right.
But I feel much more ethical saying that than just going along with the herd.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, what some of my atheist friends do is simply abstain completely from saying the Pledge of Allegiance. And as a public official, I don't feel comfortable doing that, because I'm, regardless of whether I felt that was a good plan or not, I'm sworn to uphold the Constitution. That's what my, and so, I mean, I absolutely do believe I'm paying allegiance to the U.S. That's part of being a public official.
I agree.
So I couldn't just abstain from the pledge because of the God part.
Mm-hmm.
See, so we've had a couple of guests on that believe that in the next 10, 15 years, it's going to be the rise of atheism. Do you think the U.S. is ever going to get over or get past religion?
Oh, I think very, very clearly it will. Well, seeing the poll results from young people these days, religion's much less important to young, students, college students and high school students today than it was to past generations. Serious religionists are pretty much marginalized. I noticed when the Pope was in England not long ago, there was some discussion in the British press about what a small percentage of Britishers really cared that the Pope was there. I think probably Catholicism is going to hang on in South America for a lot longer than it elsewhere. It seems to be almost on the rise there, evangelical Catholicism. But I think it's fading here. Church attendance is fading. Polls show that most people who attend church, God is not the main reason they attend church. It's the social community aspect that really is attractive. And a funny aspect of that is I'm an active member with the Unitarian Universalist Church here, where our minister is an open atheist. And I like the social aspect of the church and the community work we do with homeless issues, with alternative sentencing programs. I helped start a jail ministry. We're the only non-Bible ministry in the jail. And I'm actually the most active church member on council, even though I'm the atheist there.
Go to church more often.
Well, no,
that's one of the things that atheists miss often,
right,
is that social piece.
That's what Tom and I have talked about is that was the big part that you missed is when we stopped going to church of, yeah, the friends that you saw, you know, twice a week for us when we went and the relationships that you developed and that just, it felt like it was severed. And that's hard. I mean, as humans, we need that connection with other people. So it's neat that you can find that where it has nothing to do with religion.
Right. In some cities, like Denver, where I was lately, the Denver atheists are having more and more social events. They've got pretty well-organized hiking, book club, frequent getting together at night spots, like bars, to have speakers. In fact, I was there I was the speaker for an afternoon then on a Sunday. And they're forming a charity, which will help channel money to worthy causes through atheism, so that the atheists are going to be identified in Denver as supporting these different aid organizations and that sort of thing. And in Minneapolis, a similar sort of thing is going on, where they've formed a money for college students that they donate. So there's an ongoing scholarship program provided by atheists, and they have regular meetings. And it takes a big city, I guess. Here we have the Ethical Society, which is in Asheville, is a small group. It's dedicatedly atheist. 20 or 30 people meet every 2 weeks. But it's spreading. And as I said, our Unitarian church here is very humanist, atheist-oriented.
We have the same thing here in Austin, of course. You know, the Atheist Experience, there's a lot of atheist groups here. Unfortunately, most of ours tend to meet on work days, which makes it a little difficult for me and Wendy, but they also...
Retirees, maybe?
they usually go in after, like around 7 o'clock in the afternoon, but because of my work schedule, it makes it very difficult to attend those.
Oh, I see.
I wish they did on Sunday. many of them also use the Universal Unitarian Church as well. I'm sorry, the Unitarian Universal Church to do a lot of their... And there's actually some atheists that refuse to go there because they call themselves a church.
I know that. Yeah, and there's so many ways to slice that. It's easy to find reasons to be critical of, almost easier sometimes to criticize the people we are closer to than, I mean, we can criticize the people we definitely disagree with on the big issues, but sometimes we get real critical about the minor stuff with the people close.
Well, yeah.
I see that in social groupings where I've heard it said that the left, that liberals form all their firing squads in a circle.
Well, Cecil, thanks so much for joining us. That's about all the time we have for the show.
Well, thanks for having me on here.
Thanks.
It's a piece of my helping to spread the word, which, as I said, I've come to find is a very important message to get out this year. And I'm pleased to have been on the show. I'm pleased you're doing the show as a regular podcast.
We're doing the best we can. This is this'll be episode number 25.
All right.
So almost halfway through the
year. That's half a year. And, nice.
Every week we've done it consistently.
Well, maybe I can talk to you again after number 50 or number 75.
Oh, I'd love to have you on again.
Oh, that sounds good.
be sure to check out Cecil's books. I'll provide a link to his blog. Thanks again, Cecil.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the show this week. We really appreciate having Cecil on. We have one more small little snippet from our discussion with Cecil that I couldn't fit in anywhere else, so I left it off here at the end, where we're talking about why you can still be good without God. Here's Cecil.
You know, people, when they say to me, well, why are you good if you aren't afraid of heaven or hell, or, you know, of that thing? And I say, how, if this is my only chance, this is my only shot at it, how could I want to do anything except good? You know, I want to share with the people I love. I want to make life better for as many people as I can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to, from my Boy Scout days, I want to leave the campsite cleaner than I found it. You know, the idea to me that you'd need to be beaten into it by being afraid of punishment is so childlike. Yeah, this is our one shot.